Christopher Holmes. I'm back again with another afternoon or evening of Zero Point Teachings. This program is coming to you from Cars, Ontario, just south of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And welcome aboard. I hope some people are returning and following this series and having drawing new listeners. The teaching presented in this radio program is really a highly unique teaching based on the synthesis of the ancient mystical teachings and modern science. It presents an alternative model of the nature of human consciousness and multidimensional existence. It's not easy to understand what I explain, and it takes time to learn the language and understand different components of what's being taught here, and also hearing it repeatedly and understanding things from different perspectives. So it all takes time to develop a certain knowledge and understanding in yourself. If you don't think what's being taught here is unusual, you simply haven't understood what's being taught. This is the only place where you can get this live online radio show with Dr. Christopher Holmes, mystic psychologist and scientist on BBS Radio. And I'd like to thank Don and Doug again for all their efforts with this BBS. It's really a unique service in the world today and most valuable to a growing community of us who are trying to understand alternate perspectives and spiritual practices and teachings and so on, healing aspects. And so this is a wonderful service, and I'm most pleased to have this opportunity to present Zero Point Teachings. And previous shows are made available at the BBS site, and we have three shows up there. I hope we're going to add a Blavatsky show over the next while. I completed a two-part series on Madame Blavatsky and the physics of the secret doctrine. And with time we're going to add to the archives there. His hint on Doug. Thanks to you guys for everything you do. These guys do so much. They also did something else very valuable for me recently. They mentioned my name and this program to Sean Fisher, who's a filmmaker from Las Vegas, who is putting together a major documentary entitled Metaphysica, and they have a website. If you want to jot down their website, it's www.metaphysia.com. And at that site, you can get a little clip of the opening to the movie and the concept of the movie. It's a beautiful little clip to view this film that they're putting together. And Sean and his film crew have been filming across the United States, from California and Washington to New York City, where I was yesterday filming with them. And I'll come to that in a minute. And this is a very valuable project, and they're trying to explore the whole new paradigm, the paradigm in healing and consciousness studies in new physics, concerns about the environment and the situation of humanity at this time in our world history, ranging from the environmental issues across a wide gamut of ideas and teachings and people. Some New Age people, some more in the scientific traditions, a wide variety, and skeptics included. And anyway, look, this documentary, they're planning now, hoping to release it in February of next year, and because they've extended their filming schedule. Okay, so anyway, I'll come back to the movie and my involvement in a moment. I didn't mean to get sidetracked a bit, but I was thanking BBS Radio because it was Don and Doug who recommended me to Metaphysia and to Sean Fisher and crew, and so I was really excited by that involvement, and I'll return to that at a later point. I've thought of maybe trying to see if I can get Sean to be interviewed on this show one day to talk about his documentary movie. Anyway, so I wanted to make a few notes before I kind of get into today's discussions and lectures and such. I'm going to open the line for anyone who would like to call in, but I'll save that to the last half hour of the show. I'm going to take about a half hour to open it, and then I'll have James Moffat on again with me today for ongoing discussions and interviews. And then the last half hour, we'll open it up to anyone who calls in, and wherever we're at, we'll try to kind of drop the conversation and address anything anyone would like to ask, or if there's anything anyone would like to contribute to our ongoing discussions. I know there's one friend out there, John Francis. If you're around today, John, I'd like to call in and say hello. I'd be pleased to hear from you. But there may be different people. So the phone number is 877-876-5227. Okay, I would like to encourage people to visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca, spelled out in letters as zero point. I haven't revised my website recently too much. Since I posted material there, I've revised both of my major books, The Heart Doctrine and Microcosm, Macrocosm. These are clearly like my most important contributions to kind of modern thought and scholarship in trying to understand the enigmas of human consciousness. So these I see as profoundly important work, this Heart Doctrine, which explores the teaching of relating consciousness and the I experience to the human heart and the depths of the human heart. And I'm actually trying to explain a higher dimensional physics of what the heart actually is and how we exist in space and zero-point fields and how we have a zero-point center I within the heart space, within the higher dimensional heart space. So I try to explore such concepts, and I draw from Judaism and Kabbalah and mystical Christianity and Vedic teachings and the chapter on the Dalai Lama's esoteric teachings on consciousness, to Buddhism and other sources to elaborate the Heart Doctrine, and most importantly from Madame Blavatsky. The concept of zero points is based on a quotation from Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine, where she says, "Material points without extension, Leibniz's monads, are the materials out of which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies." It's a very complex quote to understand this. He's saying, like, what it suggests is each living being has a central zero point center, and it's somehow your bodies are constructed around a zero point center. So there's actually a physics to this. Just like the universe emerged from a singularity out of the quantum vacuum at the beginning of time and expanded within without from a zero point, and grew into a huge universe. And if it ever contracts the universe, it could all contract back without within, back to a zero point, back into the quantum vacuum, nothingness. That's how Madame Blavatsky in 1888 was describing the origin and fate of the universe. It emerges from a first point of differentiation out of negative existence. It expands within without, it withdraws without within, back to a singularity point and back into the quantum vacuum. So I'm actually suggesting that this is a model of the origins of human consciousness, that consciousness within ourselves in a way has higher dimensional zero point origins. And through these talks, I'm trying to elaborate how this might work and what it might involve and why it's important. In a way, the mystical path is to know self. Last week, I discussed about how many selves do we have, all the different aspects to ourself. Gurdjieff calls them the centers, the seven aspects to ourself. And then we have our personality and our essence and our false personality, different aspects to ourself. In a way, we do not usually think of ourselves as singular. We think we're manifold. We have all these different aspects to ourselves. Man's name is Legion, it says in the Bible, meaning we have many, many eyes. The mystical and occult teachings say that a human being, however, has a central eye. And this is, in a way, the secret of secrets, is to understand this singular eye and what it might be. It might be, in Kabbalah, it's called, in one work, Sparks of Holiness. A Sufi master refers to divine sparks. Shirley MacLaine calls it the God particle. The languages are different, but the concept is the same. In Vedas, it's called the Jiva Atma, the individual self, described as a point particle smaller than any material particle. So it's like a zero point of a source of inner light, and it's established within the space of the heart. And there's actually a higher dimensional physics towards how a singularity within the higher dimensional space of the heart, around that, creates different bodies so that that being is embodied into different bodies. And the material body is the outgrowth of all these processes which occur within higher dimensions. In a way, we come into the body from above, and we ourselves, in our essential nature, are separate from the body. The body is simply a vehicle for our physical expression and life experience. Swami Prabhupada says, psychologists and scientists, they only study a man's clothes. They only study the outer garments and think that that's all there is. And he's asked, would that be progress of science if we only studied the clothes? And in a way, that's what science does, and thinks that man is simply his clothes, the material body and brain. What I am trying to elaborate is how the mystics have depicted and explained a higher dimensional physics of what we really are as beings. And that all has to do with the mysteries of the heart. And the concept that there is a singular eye within us, a divine spark, some source that at a later point I'll talk about how, in a way, we have a monad in hyperspace. Okay, that's a useful phrase, like a singular eye that exists in higher dimensional space, seven-dimensional hyperspace. And this little monad in hyperspace with its spinergy creates around itself different material bodies, so that higher dimensional element comes down like a ladder of creation into different planes of being. In Kabbalah, it is said that God emanates, creates, forms, and makes the four worlds, representing the four elements, fire, air, water, and earth. Emanation, we have a divine spark source. That's the spark of holiness. The world of creation is the world above, the heaven world, the spirit world. The world of formation is the psychical and ensouling world that underlies material reality. And the world made is the material body, the outermost product of the whole interior tree. So there's actually a kind of higher dimensional physics to what human consciousness is, and it emerges within without through the nature of the heart. So I argue in this that human consciousness originates through the heart and is distributed through the body, through the subtle anatomy, where it's divided by three channels into a system of seven chakras, which underlie the physical body. And then it creates seven centers or aspects to a human being. So I'm, So there's a higher dimensional physics that underlies the material body, and the whole material body is informed by these hidden dimensions of intelligence and ensoulment within a human being. In the way Blavatsky describes, all the forces of nature are one of seven modifications of the ceaseless eternal breath, which is the fundamental holo movement in hyperspace. There's a ceaseless activity. It's like the modern physicist says, the quantum vacuum is never still. There's ceaseless activity at the level of the quantum vacuum. So that fundamental holo movement, when creation happens, it's modified on seven invisible points. It's not just one zero point. Well, one zero point then emerges into seven zero points. So a person in your chakra system, each chakra has a zero point center. Each chakra has different two aspects to it. The center, which is neutral in sense, and it's the energy concentrated most infinitely, and then it has the radial part of the chakra. So each chakra has a zero point center, and all those seven zero point centers are all part of one. This is all in the interior physics of a human being, but it's hidden from our view because it's not in simply material, it's not simply in matter, it's in the fields which underlie and sustain all the activity within the material body. So I'm trying to explain this kind of alternate model of human consciousness through this model of the nature of the nothingness and the quantum vacuum, and that we have zero point origins, that consciousness is light, and we're exploring the mysteries of the Divine Mother as form of seven-dimensional hyperspace. This is an ancient mystery teaching of the seven-dimensional nature of the Divine Mother. In Kabbalah, there's 10 sephira, or spheres of intelligence and being in the universe. And the highest three are called the supernal triad, have to do with the nature of the divine being, or God as a triune nature. We try to understand God in a triune way. One of those triune elements is unspeakable. But then that unspeakable element, there are also the opposing elements, so the Divine Mother and the Divine Father. The Divine Father represents spiritual principle, and we might take it as light, whereas the Divine Mother is Bina, is the Divine Mother, and she represents the nature of the material realms. And Bina represents space itself. Space as the plenum, as containing all possible realms of material creation, are latent in the ether of the Divine Mother. When creation happens, a ray of light penetrates into the Divine Mother, and it reveals these potencies and levels already latent in the plenum. So these things appear, manifest out of non-existence. It is said that Bina, within herself, gives birth to the lower seven sephira. Okay, so again, in Kabbalah, the Divine Mother has this hidden sevenfold nature. Okay, these are some of the concepts from Blavatsky and some of the concepts I'm trying to present. I'm saying that these are beautifully lucid, intelligent, comprehensive concepts, but that explain all other kinds of phenomena and give us a different model of the nature of reality. Now, it's not a different model from what's in the mystery teachings, but it's the model that is hidden in the mystery teachings. So I'm trying to explain some of the hidden teachings in the secret doctrine and the Kabbalah and other esoteric Christianity. I'm trying to explain some of the secret teachings of these diverse traditions. And in certain essential teachings, these traditions are all the same. The suns expand and contract through their own selves and hearts. That's what the stanzas of Zen say in the secret doctrine. The suns, meaning all living beings or created beings, they expand and contract through their own selves and hearts. So there's just like a universe expands from the singularity, so we have a singular eye within the deep dimensions of the heart in life. And everything in creation is spun around that, a web spun of spirit and matter through different planes of being. In our lives, in this teaching, we want to recover that essential identity which is already existent within us. It's already established as what we are, but in a way it's hidden from us by different veils, things which obscure our understanding of ourself and of what life is. And that all brings us to trying to understand the enigmas of human consciousness and how humankind generally live in a psychopathological state. The masses of humanity, in a way, have established what Gurdjieff calls a false consciousness system, which is centered in the mind. And all the mystical paths point towards the essential nature of awakening the self within the heart. Gurdjieff calls it the higher emotional center. He associates it with what he calls an organ in the region of the breast. But Gurdjieff explains that at one time, though, human beings became so abnormal that their essential emotional center dropped from the heart down into the complex of nerves of the autonomic nervous system. Most importantly, the solar plexus. Just below the heart, 6 or 8 inches down, is the solar plexus, the main plexus of the autonomic nervous system. It's a place where we can feel anxiety and fear, or we can also feel warmth and fullness, different feelings associated with the solar plexus. So our emotional center drops down. People talk about gut feelings. Well, sometimes people's feeling centers are in their guts and in their solar plexus. So in a way, we want to move our emotional center from the lower centers. We want to move it up into the heart, and that's an awakening process if we can achieve that. There are said to be 3 lower centers below the heart. Normally, human consciousness is conditioned down into the 3 lower centers. What we need to do is balance and develop those lower centers and turn that triunity into a new, achieve a different integration and attain the next level, man number 4 for Gurdjieff, which involves the awakening of the heart or the higher emotional center. And then beyond that, we might attain higher levels of objective consciousness or cosmic consciousness or God consciousness. But most importantly and directly is the awakening of the human heart. See, I disagree fundamentally with many people who think our highest self is the crown chakra or above the crown chakra, or that our highest self is above us and comes down. In a way, I say we come from within without through the dimensions of the heart. And from the heart, all the energies are distributed through the channels and the chakras, through the subtle anatomy, and life comes into a human being. And the consciousness is connected to the breath and the blood flow. That's how we are ensouled by spirit. See, there's really a threefold nature. There's a material body, the spiritual body, but in between is the process of ensoulment by which spirit is brought down into matter. in Blavatsky's secret doctrine, that is called Fohat. And there are said to be seven Fohats. Fohats impress divine mind upon material nature. They carry the influence of spiritual intelligences and impress them in matter. Blavatsky says there are seven Fohats, and these are cosmic electricity by which higher intelligence animates material matter. Okay, I don't want to get too far afield at the moment these are the kinds of teachings I'm trying to articulate to develop an alternate model of what we are as higher dimensional beings. See, I would maintain human beings ourselves, we are already extraterrestrial. Think of what that word means, extraterrestrial. Well, what do we mean to say when we say a human being is terrestrial? Well, it implies that all I am is material mass, such that when I die and my body's on the ground, it's done. I'm just a simply a biological being. I have no spirit or soul that survives death. So science has ignored for over a century the idea of human beings having a spirit or soul. So I would say different elements in us correspond to different levels of the cosmic octave. In a way, I would say our higher self is in the sun. And really, we come from the sun. And actually, at another level, we might come from the starry world beyond the sun. So I would maintain that a human being, as a microcosm of the macrocosm, you contain within yourself influences of the earth and the moon and the planets and the sun and the stars and the all, that the influences of all these worlds interpenetrate us simultaneously, and we exist at all of these levels of the seven-dimensional holographic universe. These are all levels in ourselves. So our body might go down to pass back into the earth, but we're sustained within the astral and the mental bodies, and we could return to the spiritual realm in the sun. See, in mystical teachings, it's realized that all of life is alive. The sun, in a way, is a spiritual being, a level of spiritual existence. The sun itself, I would maintain, has a zero-point center. So the sun is not just a mass. Material scientists think everything is just physical. They don't realize everything has a metaphysical nature. So the sun is not simply a mass of hydrogen and helium burning away and dissipating with time. Instead, it's a higher dimensional being that creates and sustains life on Earth in an intelligent way. The sun is a spiritual intelligence, and Blavatsky explains the rays of the sun, they create and inform life on Earth. Earth doesn't arise, as the pseudoscientists say, through accident and happenstance and lucky coincidences, the evolution by accident in modern science. Instead, there's an inherent design within all of creation. So we want to try to understand ourselves and the world in this way and learn to cultivate seeing and understanding the world in the mystical way that reveals to us the mysteries. So zero-point teaching, zero-point radio on BBS, we're exploring BBS radio, we're exploring the mysteries of consciousness, the mysteries of creation, and the mysteries of God. I know I don't understand these mysteries. You know, as we go through life, layer upon layer, there's layer upon layer of illusion we strip away and levels of growth and illumination we might experience. And none of us understand and know the mysteries and have Mr. God stuck in our back pocket. It's just not like that. the mind longs to know the mysteries of the heart. And I hope these zero-point teachings here help you to understand with your mind some of the mysteries of the heart. Okay, so I'm going to just say a few things to switch as my introductory. I like to give an introductory spiel. I just get going and want to meander a little bit there. Okay, and we'll come back here. Okay, so I mentioned the movie Metaphysia. Meta and then P-H-Y-S-I-C-A. I'm not, usually we refer to metaphysics. Chris, Metaphysia is a variant on that. Yeah, Jim?
Could I just interject something?
Yeah,
you gave that website earlier. It's wrong. It's not.
Oh, sorry.
You said www.metaphysia.com. It's actually Metaphysia. That's right. Not with a C, like M-E-T-A-P-H-Y-S-I-A, but it's .net.
Oh, yeah, net. Yeah,
yeah.
Thanks, Jim.
Okay.
Great. Okay, thanks. As you see, Jim's in the background there. He's ready to provide support and comment as we go along here. Okay, so Metaphysia. So I was invited down to New York, and I just got back this morning. Actually, I drove from 1 o'clock last night till about 10, 11 o'clock this morning, returning from New York City, and I thought I'd better stay awake. I thought if I went to sleep, getting up would be worse. So if I seem high energy, I guess that reflects my state a little bit here, running on a little energy, a lot of energy and insight and inspiration. So I was down in Sean Fisher's putting this movie together, as I mentioned, and was down there trying to explain. I was very pleased with aspects of my interview. I realize it's so, the breadth of my work is so broad. It's funny, I was so pleased with the interview, and then afterwards I realized I hadn't even mentioned zero points. I'd never used that term. I don't think I ever mentioned Blavatsky even. In a way, I got more into talking about the psychopathology of humanity and the necessity in terms of the evolution of human society for humanity to understand the next level of human consciousness, this level of self-consciousness, which involves the awakening of the human heart. In the classical literature, a Buck in Cosmic Consciousness, he kind of thought man already has self-consciousness. And most scientists today think that man already has self-consciousness. But we don't understand how what we think of self-consciousness is more structured and aspect of our false consciousness system, and it's more based in the mind and in acquired ego, and it's not rooted into our essential nature. So I talked about like the idea of the evolution of consciousness and the psychopathology of man, and got to talk about creation out of the quantum vacuum and how Kabbalah and Blavatsky were talking about this hundreds of years before the modern physicists. Got to talk about seven-dimensional hyperspace. I talked about that. It's such an important teaching. And then I got to partake in a panel with a number of other people there for the filming. I'd like to thank Jody Sirota, who runs a Meta Center there, who opened her facility for the filming, and Jody was part of the panel, and James and Desiree Hertak and other new friends that we met, and we had an interesting discussion about the Divine Mother and the importance of the feminine consciousness. And I would say, in a way, the heart consciousness is feminine consciousness relative to the more masculine head-dominated consciousness. And, of course, that we all have both the masculine and feminine principles within ourselves, and yeah, both need to cultivate the depth of both of those. So it was a fascinating day, and arrived back late last night. We'll have to watch. I'll keep you in touch about the movie as it comes along, and I'll put up, there's a contact to the site up on my website. You can see that. Okay, how am I doing here? Oh, 37 minutes, not too bad. Okay, one other announcement. The other thing I'm doing, I'm very excited about my last 2 weeks. I've been revising my book called The Divine Mysteries on Madame H.P. Blavatsky and the Cosmogenesis of the Secret Doctrine. And this is a book I completed about 3 years ago, just a smaller version based on the Within Without series. But after doing 2 shows on BBS Radio on Blavatsky and the Secret Doctrine, I felt so inspired, I'm completely revamping and expanding upon that book, and I hope to have it done, finish the first edition of that within the next 2 to 3 weeks. So I'm very pleased with that and would like to get back to other shows on the Secret Doctrine. And it was fun being in New York. I kind of realized, in New York, we spent so many hours kind of driving there and getting there. Now, you have to understand that I was going downtown Manhattan, and there's so many people and cars and high buildings and everything everywhere. Okay, and normally I live in cars, and the most exciting thing around are my 4 ducks and the river. So I go jump from there into downtown Manhattan, and it was thrilling and tiring and really a wonderful time and exciting time. I'd like to spend some time in New York. In fact, if any listeners are out there, know people who would like to invite me anywhere to give some seminars or talk some on my teaching, I'm open to really traveling or seeking any opportunity to try to put forward these ideas. But anyway, I'll throw that out there and just say what fun. I'd like to thank Sean and the director and the film crew, Jody at the center in New York, a beautiful center there. And I'd like to thank again Don and Doug for promoting my work and mentioning me. Okay, so I'd like to move on to the next kind of phase of our show. And I have my friend, lifelong friend, Jim Moffat in the background there. And last week we kind of started, Jim is going over a series of programs to interview me, and Jim knows my work theoretically and where it exists in relationship to science and philosophy, more so than anyone else. He can articulate and understand those things. So he's an ideal interviewer, as well as having learned and known me through the years and learned together. So he is a co-host for this feature of the show, and we're going to kind of do different things as we go along. We're discussing doing a series of book reviews. See, I think it's very important. Blavatsky always said, archaic teachings must be compared with modern science. So what I want to try to do is compare what I'm teaching to other people, and I have a critique of most other things out there. I mean, many, many things have values, but many, many things are off in what's being taught, and I think it creates babble. Gurdjieff talked about babble, how everyone uses different languages and words, and we have such confusion. We don't even realize it. But anyway, we're talking about doing a series of book reviews, and I'm just thanking Jim. He sent me a fascinating book, Conversations on Consciousness, which I don't know if you've had any time to get into that yet, Jim.
I haven't read it yet, no.
I think we really must have some discussion of some of the chapters in there. I think it would be really valuable.
It looks
not
very
today. I'm not today. I'm saying in the future as a program.
Yeah, it looks very interesting, and as I say, it's pretty much all of the so-called heavyweight thinkers on consciousness today, the people who are generally recognized within mainstream psychology and science.
Yeah, I was reading Stuart Hammerhoff, who looks a little bit at the quantum physics of consciousness, relating it to the microtubules and such, eh? But aspects of that work are very interesting, some things he has to say, although he identifies everything as only being up in the mind, in the head, again, which is a fundamental problem. But otherwise, we'll have to discuss that. He has a most funny quote in there. He's asked by the author if he believes in free will. And I just have to read you his answer to that question. Okay, the Sue
Blackmore.
Blackmore, thank you. So sound as though you believe in free will, and Stuart says, "I have no choice but to believe in free will." I have no choice but to believe in free will. I wonder, is that a tautology? Isn't that funny? That must be. That was so funny. I rolled out of my bed for 5 minutes laughing when I read that.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. Wow.
Okay, we'll take a break from what we've been doing and come back. We want to pick up on our interview today, and you'd mentioned that you had done some review over the past while. Last week's show was a lot on the fourth way definitions of psychology, and you were mentioning that you had some time and had gone back over that some of that material. So maybe you'd like to share a little bit of your review for us today.
Yeah. First of all, just a couple of comments. Who'd have thought that?
Okay,
Who'd have thought a book on consciousness would have such an incredibly funny statement in it? That's very, very good. That's a keeper. Second is my brother Doug, who lived in the wilds of northern British Columbia in a cabin with no running water or electricity for 7 years. On his first visit to New York, said that the definition of a nanosecond is the time that a New York traffic light turns from red to green, and from that time to when a New Yorker sounds his horn. He couldn't believe as soon as lights would change, people would just start honking. It was just like, it was so frantic.
Yeah.
He just really could not grasp that whatsoever.
It's such a different pace of life, the kind of stress of it all, and people. I guess you get deconditioned to it and adapt to it. And,
yeah, well, you know, I live in Toronto in a huge city, and it, you know, at times you did definitely. That's exactly what happens. So you're conditioned or you're deconditioned, but you're desensitized to it all. I live in a city of many millions of people with an incredible amount of traffic and an incredible amount of activity. And sometimes I just sort of stop and when I'm driving around, try to grasp, you know, the complexity of everything that's going on at the same time. Usually you're just focused in on your own little world and whatever you're trying to do, and you just are almost oblivious to it. It's a kind of a coping mechanism all. But sometimes when you open up to it, you just realize that, you know, the incredible energy that's involved in a big urban setting like that. And it's quite wonderful in a way. It's quite frightening in a way, too, at times. But to get back to, I don't know if when you were mentioning earlier about your books and stuff, I don't know if you mentioned your website, where people could find your website. You might as well just plug it one more time.
www.zeropoint.ca.
Yeah.
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 Well, yeah, I've sold hardly any books on my site. I can't believe how my books sell there. They sit there and there isn't more response, but I have to promote my work, and my work is really quite unknown, and I guess that's, you know, why this show is so valuable to me. And
last week when we started to talk, I explained a few things that we've known one another for almost 40 years now, since high school, and we went to undergraduate school at Carleton University in Ottawa, and then you went on to do your PhD in psychology, and I worked for a couple of years and then went back to do my master's in psychology. And while we were in graduate school, you discovered the fourth way teaching of G.I. Gurdjieff and Uspensky through his Uspensky's book In Search of the Miraculous, which really revolutionized your ideas about what the nature of psychology was and what you wanted to do as a psychologist. And I began the interview last week by asking you the question. In your work, on your website, in your work, you describe yourself as a mystic scientist, and you know, most people would consider that term to be an oxymoron. There must be a story there. And then you started to talk about, well, you know, how you'd been introduced to mystical and esoteric teachings. And then we went on, we talked a little bit about the Gurdjieff material. And when I sort of prompted you by saying that, you know, that the fourth way teaching of Gurdjieff really led you to, you know, completely revamp your understanding of what psychology was, you said, oh, yeah, yeah. And then you started going through, Yaspensky offers eight definitions of psychology, and you went through and you made a comment upon each of the, ongoing commentary on these eight definitions, which was amounted to about a half an hour lecture on it, which is very interesting. And I just thought that there were a lot of different points in that, that maybe we could go back and sort of, you know, reconnect with what we talked about before and go over some of those definitions again.
Yeah, oh, it's such rich material, absolutely worthwhile. Maybe you want to take the lead a bit. Now, I realized afterwards, actually, in our conversation after, you mentioned you came on there and I forgot to mention the first one, so which I did never mention, which Uspensky says there are two psychologies.
Exactly.
Two completely different traditions of psychology. Now, Western psychology is often dated to 1879. I think Wilhelm Wundt founded the first psychological laboratory in Germany, Leipzig. And that was a kind of beginning of experimental psychology. And initially, a very interesting program of kind of introspectionism and phenomenology. And that was a roots of modern psychology, which throughout has kind of denied the existence of spirit and soul. And then Uspensky says, but then there's a whole other tradition that goes back, is an ancient tradition. And I would include among that is all the mystery teachings from Kabbalah to Judah to Sufism, yoga. He mentions Freemasonry, astrology, all these different teachings or aspects of this alternate psychology. And all these alternate psychologies, he says, deal with the possibility of man's possible evolution. And he explains by evolution, he's not talking simply about the biological evolution of the material body, but he's saying that we can also undergo a form of psychological evolution in terms of rising in our level of being, attaining higher levels within our own development as being, as beings. And he describes that also according to the law of the octave, and it's like most people in life sound do, re, mi. And they're physically, emotionally, or mentally, intellectually centered. But most people get no further than the man number three. They don't get to the level of man number four, which is the beginning of awakening of the higher emotional center. And then they don't attain the higher levels of five, six, and seven. So we can really attain these different levels of being. And there's a whole mystery teaching about this inner evolution of the individual spirit soul through some kind of cosmic process. So in the fourth way, psychology involves this idea of the psychology of man's possible evolution. Peter, maybe you want to comment on that.
Yeah, well,
for bringing that up.
Because it's sort of the fundamental premise, and it, you know, it sets up the whole idea of esotericism. But he has this wonderful phrase when he says that there, you know, all psychological teachings can be divided into two categories. And the first, and this I love this, is he says that the first study man as they find him, or such as they suppose him to be. And then he says that's all of modern psychology falls into that category. And then he contrasts that with the ancient teachings, which, as you say, are about the from the point of view of this possible of human beings' possible evolution. And he says that throughout the ages there have been numerous psychological doctrines and disciplines associated with various religious, philosophical schools, mystery cults, and symbolic teachings. And he says the latter include alchemy, astrology, and magic in ancient times, and more recently, occultism, theosophy, and Freemasonry. And when he says that, well, the other thing that he says, which is along these lines, is that the first answer to the, this is a quote, the first answer to the question, what is psychology, should be that psychology is the study of the principles, laws, and facts of man's possible evolution, unquote. And when you contrast that, when you take that, that differentiation he makes between the ancient psychology and the new psychology, you realize that, that really these ancient psychologies are psychologies which are aimed at self-transformation and self-realization through a process of psycho-spiritual transformation. And modern psychology really just deals with change. It doesn't deal with the idea of transformation. And I'd say even like the when you talk about to people about esoteric psychologies or these ancient psychologies, people always bring up Jung, for instance, and say, well, what about Jung? But even Jung's ideas aren't really about self-transformation. They're, in a sense, they're about individuation and self-fulfillment, but they're not really about transforming consciousness. And that's the fundamental difference between these ancient teachings and the modern and modern psychology. And as Uspensky says, in a sense, psychology is the oldest science. Like as you said, like generally, it's, as psychology students, we learn well. Psychology is a new science, and it originated in Wilhelm Wundt's laboratory, you know, 125 years ago. But really, he says that, that Uspensky says it's the oldest science and, in a sense, a forgotten science because most people don't recognize that psychology, the psychology of transformation in the, is inherent in all these different traditions, like the magical tradition, the alchemical tradition, the astrological tradition. Those are all studies of different realms of nature and existence, but they all have the central goal of transforming consciousness.
Yeah, and developing these latent faculties.
Yeah, awakening these dormant faculties within us to realize higher self and the higher states.
Yeah, yeah, and that we actually, through the higher emotional center, experience forms of objective emotions. And through the higher intellectual center, we can see into patterns of creation and perceive the mysteries of the universe. So he has higher states of objective consciousness beyond the attaining of self-consciousness.
Yeah.
So he has this whole inner model. There's nothing comparable. Who has anything comparable in modern psychology? They're still mainly stuck back at thinking there's a mind and a body.
Yeah.
Now they realize more, everybody recognizes emotions. Psychology is gradually coming to this triune distinction of head, heart, and hands, or thinking, feeling, and sensation. Like we see the emergence of interest now in emotional intelligence and seeing the importance of that. But that's relatively new in psychology, yet alone do they conceive, as Gurdjieff talks, he talks of developing or crystallizing the higher being bodies for the life of the soul. And as we crystallize these higher being bodies, we acquire different faculties and have different kinds of experiences. So there's really nothing comparable in modern psychology that I know of.
No.
I guess some people in the consciousness literature like talk of levels of consciousness and such, but that's, I'm thinking more in the mainstream.
Yeah, and as you say, it's interesting because originally, like, when Wundt and the introspectionists in the beginning of psychology sort of were onto the idea of studying oneself to try to know consciousness, but then little by little they weren't able to kind of classify things in a meaningful way, and they sort of were stuck on just their observations and didn't seem to be able to know what to do with those observations, and then little by little that sort of dropped out. And then Freud came along and you know, it made the great discovery that there are unconscious motives and processes that influence behavior and thinking and feeling and everything. But then Freud was sort of regarded as pseudoscientific, and behaviorism changed the definition of psychology from the study of the soul, which is what it literally means, to the study of behavior, and did away with the notion of consciousness as being unobservable and therefore immaterial to the study of psychology, which is sort of the ultimate irony. And that persisted for almost 40 years before finally people began to realize, well, we do have a mind, you know, and we do have some sort of consciousness. But what it's interesting, like I say, the introspectionist didn't have a way to systematize these ideas, and that's one of the things that in the fourth way is taught, is that to study yourself, to study consciousness, you must study yourself, but you must study yourself systematically, because self-study undertaken without a system, sort of willy-nilly, is completely useless, because you can't put in order the facts of experience.
Yeah, you can't arrive at the distinction simply on your own. I mean, you must, but you need a system. Yeah, it's not just any kind of self-study. It's having a system of more objective knowledge rather than subjective knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah, provided by the Gurdjieff teaching, especially with his system of the centers, the seven centers, and how each of these centers is a faculty of mind of ourself, a dimension of our being. So in a way, we don't just have one mind. Like all modern science thinks we simply have a mind in the brain, whereas Gurdjieff explains we really have seven minds all within the same organism, and that it's a very profound teaching. And we went through some of the analysis of the centers and then the study of the centers, and then Gurdjieff mentions we have to study consciousness, and there are different levels of consciousness. So we have to study the centers and the study of consciousness, and they kind of go together.
Yeah, in that regard, I realized one thing that we didn't talk very much about last week, which is kind of it kind of provides the basis for all this too, and it's sort of implicit in the definitions, but we didn't explicitly deal with this, I don't think in any detail anyway, which is, why don't you talk a little bit about how, like, this is, I think, was the great shock to you and I, which is that the essential claim that Gurdjieff makes is that our normal waking state is a state of waking sleep, that we're really unconscious all the time, in a sense that the idea of the unconscious in Freudian psychology is a misnomer, because everything's unconscious. And he says that we don't have a central eye, we're not a unified eye, that we have many little eyes, and that we cannot do, that everything happens. And that in order to awaken, to have real eye, to know oneself, we must develop our consciousness through self-study. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Wow, well, that is an excellent description. Yeah, so he says that the title of my book is called Psychological Illusions. And Gurdjieff kind of explains we have to understand these fundamental mistakes we make. The first is thinking that we already know what real I is and that we have a central I. We do, but in a way, the way we're conditioned, we don't. Instead, we're so multifaceted with all these different aspects of ourselves. So we don't have or haven't attained real I, which is the aim in attaining the fourth level, to attain real I. And he says also we're so conditioned. Everything in life conditions us from all the influences of parents and families and conditioning and abuse and society and TV. Everything around us conditions us from our birth, and it forms a second kind of outer personality, a persona, which in a way your essence is under your persona, and your personality forms around your essence. It's how your essence interacts with the world and is shaped by outside influences. So we acquire this false consciousness system, and we're conditioned by all the things that happen to us in life and our personal characteristics and quirks and quarks and so on. So essentially man becomes an automaton, controlled by the environment around him and by everything that's happened to him through his life. And it's like we're walking robots or automatons who have been conditioned and simply repeat those patterns of conditioning. We're conditioning intellectually, emotionally, physically, in all areas. So, and we end up in a state of waking sleep. We're awake and we function, but we're so little conscious of what we are or what we're doing or what's going on within us. We're so little present to the world. So we have to awaken. All Gurdjieff explains all mystical esoteric teachings have to do with this idea of awakening. It's through the Bible, it's through all the esoteric traditions. We have to awaken. So we have to awaken from the state of sleepwalking and conditioning and attachment and and we have to understand that. And understanding that's not a simple thing. It's layer upon layer within our own nature. And we have to begin to study that in a systematic way. So the illusions that we have a central I, there's the illusion that we have real will. So the chief says everything happens from the moment you're born to the moment you die. Things happen, happen, happen. And you think you're carrying the current, whereas really the current is sweeping you along. Everything is happening mechanically, and you can do nothing, he says. Everything happens. Your thoughts are conditioned, your emotions, everything is. So we have to try to wake up from this condition and free ourselves through the awakening of consciousness within ourselves. So the illusion of a central I, the illusion of will, and the illusion that we are properly conscious, a third kind of illusion that goes together, that really we have this false consciousness system. And Gurdjieff explains our true consciousness passes into what we call the subconscious. So our true consciousness is really more subconscious in us now. So we have to, in a way, break down some of this false personality and get back to our essence in order to wake up and attain true self-consciousness. So that's some, as you say, Jim, like those are some of the most basic ideas, like Gurdjieff's depiction of our waking sleep state. Those illusions and all that those entail.
Yeah. I remember that when you were initially exploring this material, you started to write your dissertation, and you based it on the fourth way psychology of consciousness and applied it to psychotherapy situation. But you came up with a term that, to describe this waking sleep, when you said that typically people are embedded in their thinking, habitual thinking, acting, and feeling, so that of themselves nothing really remains in any situation, that there's no I who's separate from their thinking, separate from their acting, separate from their feeling, who observes and impartially witnesses what's going on. And that's the kind of that's what Gurdjieff, I think, would describe as self-consciousness or a proper consciousness, and that's what's so rare, is that most of the time we're just completely embedded or asleep in these habitual patterns of thinking, acting, and feeling. And so essentially, you know, the idea in the fourth way is to observe this in yourself, to try to determine if this is true. As Gurdjieff says, you know, there's no faith or belief in any of this. On the contrary, you have to determine this for yourself by observing yourself systematically to see if this is in fact an objective description of your psychological world. And I think both of us were completely shocked when we started to observe ourselves and realized that, you know, you basically, our existence is consisted of exactly this, that we really weren't unified conscious beings who were doing things, but we were more like hapless automatons who were being buffeted about by external circumstances and our conditioning, and who really weren't able to wake up or to do things. And as much as that was kind of devastating in a way, it was incredibly liberating too, because it opens you to the idea of, well, what would it be like to even wake up for even a little bit, which I think you get a sense of when you start to study yourself in that way.
Yeah, it gave us such a rich language for self-observation. Like, I always felt about the fourth way. Uspensky said, if you learn nothing else, learn to struggle with negative emotions. Mm. So we learned that phrase, negative emotions, by which anger, hatred, boredom, resentment, all different kinds of negative, worry, stress, all different kinds of negative emotions. And everyone has so many different kinds of negative emotions. And I was working as a clinical psychologist then, as I still do, and I could just see, oh, that's all a clinical psychology. It's all about different negative emotional states, depressions, anxieties, paranoias, and so on. And it was interesting. I remember the example of my thesis about how people are embedded in their own functioning. So the paranoid person, for instance, who thinks other people are out to get him, he perceives the world through his own paranoia. He isn't self reflectively aware. He's not aware of his own paranoia. Instead, he sees it as other people instead of seeing his own nature, his own inner functioning. So the paranoid person is not self-consciously aware of how paranoid they are. They're not witnessing or aware of that. Instead, they perceive the world through it. So they're embedded in it. Or a person who's depressed, in a state of depression, and they have depressive thoughts and feelings and ruminations and self-depreciating comments and so on, they don't see how their own activity creates this depressive state. So they're not self-consciously aware of what's going on within them that creates that condition. So we have to become aware of what goes on through studying what goes on in our minds and our emotions and in the physical nature. And we learn to distinguish centers and the wrong work of centers, with the idea of first just studying the whole system, but then gradually of learning to be freer and freer of negative emotions and imagination, particularly internal considering, which is reworking events over and over in our minds afterwards, or imaginings in the futures and so on. So we try to cultivate awareness of these things going on in ourselves, and then learning to observe it and learning to let it go and to be more present in the moment. So it felt so liberating. During those early years, Jim, didn't we just feel so light-filled, eh? Like just so many insights into everything. And
I think the phrase I used when I was writing about it, it felt like it was in an animating state of grace at times. It was almost, everything was filled with meaning. That's what I remembered particularly, is that everything seemed new, everything seemed re-enchanted, everything seemed to possess that or be imbued with a light and a magic that you know, before it was just mundane reality, but now it was like seeing things and seeing through things at the same time. You know, all the things that I'd heard before and had been conditioned to understand in a certain way, it all just seemed to open up and this occurred over a period of probably about 3 or 4 years, where part of it was all the time we were learning more and more about these things and putting more and more, making more and more connections and getting more and more of a comprehensive understanding of how all this fit together. And I think that was part of the really exciting thing too, is that every philosophical or psychological system or theory that I'd studied, the more complex it got, the more vague it would get. Whereas with the fourth way, the more complex it got, the more comprehensive and precise it got. Like, it didn't lose anything. In fact, it gained something with each new connection that it'd make. And that to me was just like completely unparalleled in my life. I'd never experienced that. And I know talking to you that you experienced the same thing at the same time. And I guess, you know, as psychology students too, like all of this material dealt with consciousness, and up until that point, I mean, I'd read various philosophical treatises on consciousness, and all I knew is that if I read anything more about consciousness, I'd understand it even less. It was all just words to me in a sense, and I'd read Husserl, who can go on for pages and pages and make perfect sense and say absolutely nothing, you know. And this is exactly the opposite. Reading that In Search of the Miraculous consists for the most part of Gurdjieff's lectures in the years 1915 to 1921, especially 1915 to 1917, and where he's describing these elements of the fourth way. And there's a quality, we talked about this before, but there's a quality of clarity and coherence and a light to these things. There's just a feel to it that's so different from anything else, any other ideas that I'd ever read. And all of a sudden I started to realize, well, consciousness is the fundamental issue in psychology. Gee, big discovery. But I mean, up until that point, nothing in my teaching, in my study of psychology, had led me to that point of view. And once I realized that, I realized like everything in psychology is upside down. You know, psychology should begin with consciousness and then study all these other things in terms of consciousness, whereas psychology studies everything but consciousness and then, yeah, you know, it tries to fit consciousness basically reduces it to the study of the psychological functions, which really isn't any farther along than Wilhelm Wundt was, you know, 125 years ago when you get right down to it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, consciousness has to be most central to the study. You've said different things I want to, I'm trying to remember different things you commented on, different things came up. Sorry? Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and I think if you'd have said to me that you know, by beginning to study consciousness, I remember, well, we made a presentation at the Canadian Psychological Convention in 1976 or 77, and in it we said that the fourth way and esoteric psychologies challenge the fundamental assumption in modern psychology that a single, continuous, undifferentiated conscious state characterizes our normal waking experience. And by that, we just meant that when you're awake, your consciousness does not consist of just a continuous state, which is basically what modern psychology assumes. Nobody makes any differentiations. But as Gurdjieff says, really, there are moments when you're closer to consciousness and moments when you're farther away from it. And that really, if you trace somebody through a whole day, there are moments when they're closer to being awake and moments when they're deeply asleep. Most of it spent in deep sleep, of course. But that this whole idea that, you know, we're single, unified beings who are awake through the whole day is completely false. I mean, it's completely wrong. And systematic self-observation and self-study reveals that very quickly.
Yeah, and then you begin to realize then that you can be more or less conscious, and then there are even levels of consciousness, more quantized shifts in the whole psychological makeup in a way.
Yeah.
But even within levels, like, we can be relatively more awake and alert versus completely lost in daydreaming. Or negative emotions, and it's all completely tied up in our own conditioned psychological functioning.
Yeah. Oh, I know what I was gonna...
So we in the Gurdjieff system, we try to study these little differences in consciousness. We start to try to be self-aware and observe or witness what goes on within ourselves. I remembered one thing. I blanked a little bit earlier because I know there was one thing I really wanted to mention. Is this concept, first we are one, then we are two, and then we are one again. And that's a work saying from Nickel. And the concept here is, first we are one. Like, an individual is embedded in the world and fused with the world. There is no separate I apart from everything that happens. We're in a state of being simply conditioned and lived out by everything that happens. So at first we are mental, we are one. And then we become two. So at the phase of becoming two, we begin to develop the process of self-observing and trying to be more self-aware of what's going on in us. So we try to enhance the experience of I observing me. So we separate the I and the me. The I is the kind of subject side, the I experience, and we observe the me. We observe what goes on in the mind. We observe our negative emotional states. We observe inwardly our habits of constricting our body or holding our breath. The I begins to see the different aspects of the me. So then we're in a way dividing ourselves in two. And through this process of dividing in two, Gurdjieff explains, we start to develop something in ourselves called work eyes that kind of connect work ideas to life. And we begin to form an aspect in ourselves. He calls it deputy steward. It's not real I. You don't have real I yet, but you form deputy steward who starts to put the house in order because it's so chaotic and unkept and so on, that the deputy steward is work ideas that you introduce into your life and try to put the household in order to get ready for the introduction of the master, which is if we attained real I, is attaining the master. So we have this phase. We are first one, fused with the world. Then we become two. This whole process of inner separation and self-observation and developing work experience. And then the aim, again, is to attain the one, the state of one. But this, the one we want to attain is real I, which is based on the development of the essence. In our original one, it's the false personality. It's how everything has conditioned us. So we have to begin to observe that false personality and conditioning, and that becoming two. And then we, if we can neutralize that, and then more and more we live in our essence, and our essence grows, and it's through the growth of essence that we attain real I. So this whole idea of first we are one, then we are two, and then we are one, I think it ties into what we were talking about, mental embeddedness. Because a mentally embedded person, he's just fused with the world. He's one. And when we begin to study with the fourth way, we started observing and being aware of ourselves and increasing awareness of the inner world and our centers and so on. And we started that whole process of self-study. And then through life, over time, aligned ourselves more and more deeply in the new growth of essence. That we want to be reborn. Gert explains the fourth way is about a second education. It's like we grow up and we're conditioned in a certain way and form our personality, and then we have to strip that down to get back to our essence. And that's like a being reborn in your essence.
Yeah, it all falls into under the rubric, too, of self-knowledge. And at one point, Gert just says, you know, that the phrase "know thyself," you know, it's very ancient and generally ascribed to Socrates, but he says it's actually much older than Socrates. And he says even the people educated in philosophy and science today don't really understand that when we speak of to know thyself means that, you know, means knowing one's machine, the human machine, like to know yourself as a mechanical being without consciousness. And he says, quote, "Man must study the structure, the functions and the laws of his organism. In the human machine, everything is interconnected. One thing is so dependent upon another that it is quite impossible to study any one function without studying all the others. In order to know one thing, one must know everything," unquote. Now, that's in that last part is, in order to know one thing, one must know everything, in a way that describes every esoteric teaching, that they're complete systems of the study of oneself and the cosmos and the connections between those two. And even though that sounds kind of silly on one level, I think, you know, I would say that's exactly right, that perfectly describes the fourth way to me. And I think that it describes the study of all esoteric teachings, is that really you have to study everything to know one thing completely, you know. I mean, but it goes in stages. It goes in different steps. And we were talking earlier about, you know, the early years of awakening to this teaching, in particular to the fourth way, and how, you know, it just shed light on everything, and everything felt sort of magical and everything. But even just listening to your introduction today, when you were talking about some aspects of the zero point teaching, I mean, every time I hear it, I hear something new. And I make a new connection. I grasp it. I mean, I was just reading your book Microcosm, Macrocosm, the second volume in the series, and I'd never really, you talk in that about the idea of sort of the emptiness at the center of consciousness. And you know, I mean, emptiness and consciousness in terms of higher states, I've read that thousands of times, but I didn't really kind of grasp it until I was reading this book, you know. So you're always learning and always making new connections and always kind of refining your understanding of these things. I mean, it's one thing to know them too. I mean, all our emphasis in these talks have mainly been about intellectually apprehending these things, but that's just part of it. I mean, you have to understand it, you have to incorporate it into your being, you have to try to to work with these ideas all the time. You know, so yeah. when the grocer shortage changes you or somebody cuts you off in traffic, you don't get pissed off and start having a negative emotion, or when you're in dire circumstances and the armoire hits you in the head as you're trying to carry it up the stairs, which is what happened to me yesterday. You don't just react, but you try to remember yourself. There are so many different instances of that where if you can understand it, you can incorporate it that much more deeply. You can apprehend it. And it's like to understand things is to know them better, and to know them better is to understand them better. And that's what I think really distinguishes all esoteric thought from all modern thought. I think most modern thought in terms of philosophical systems is quite limited, because I don't really think it penetrates to the heart of being, and I don't think it addresses the really essential issues of consciousness, which esoteric teachings do.
Yeah. Well, so much.
Oh, yeah.
I remember Uspensky in one of his books saying, if you could know everything there was to know, even about one thing, say this ashtray, and then all that would entail. Okay, so first here I have an ashtray. Well, you'd have to know the ashtray and what it's made of, and then there were people who made it, and of certain materials, and where did those materials come from, which you trace back to the origin of the universe. All the materials are created here from the origins of the universe. Okay, so to understand an ashtray takes you into the origins of the universe, and then that ashtray exists within space. So to understand the ashtray, we have to understand space. And then to understand the ashtray, we have to understand this being that's trying to apprehend the ashtray. So we have to understand the human consciousness of this being apprehending the ashtray. So it's like how one thing, to understand one thing fully, you have to understand the whole.
Yeah.
But you can't kind of begin with the whole. You have to first learn to differentiate the parts, which is like the study of the centers and studies of consciousness and trying to learn this language and study yourself. We've got to see the parts and then over time understand the larger whole. And as you say, like these teachings, I've always felt, well, I haven't always felt it. It took a while to realize it. They're organic. They grow in you in a certain way that's impossible to describe. It's an inner alchemy that it brings about through studies in the inner world and becoming aware of oneself and learning to be more free of negative emotions and imagination and learning to be more present in your life and learning to try to enhance the awakeness of your heart center. All these things help to awaken us. It enriches our lives. And we grow in this knowledge. It's something that brings about this inner change. And as we learn more and more, then we can understand next things. Like there's so much. It just opens up such vistas of knowledge and understanding. It's kind of a way. It's a teaching you can apply to anything in life. I this mystical perspective. We can talk about the nature of the sun, the nature of matter, dreams, anything we want to talk about. We can, you know, have a whole perspective that we can understand anything in life in trying to understand it more in relationship to the whole. So mystical perspective kind of gives us that way of trying to understand the relationship of the parts to the whole. I remember in my early writings, I used to like that story of Humpty Dumpty, and Humpty Dumpty was kind of like God. Okay, he was like the broad, the egg. Sat in a wall, and then Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, and he shatters into all these different pieces. And then all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. And I always thought, oh, that's all this, us scientists and philosophers and artists, all of us, we kind of put Humpty together again, and then there's so many pieces. So then I elaborated on the story. All these people gathered up the different pieces, and people studied different pieces and developed a whole science of what the yolk was or what the shell were, the curvature, and all everybody became specialists in little bits. So we all became little bit scientists. So that's the problem today. Everybody, not everybody, I don't mean to be so grand, but we're all a little bit scientists. We study one finger of life, and we think we're a scientist. Where in a way, to understand even one finger, you have to understand the whole of which a finger is a part. And science ordinarily lacks that perspective of the relationship of the part to the whole, whereas mystical teachings provide you a whole other organic way of trying to understand and relate these things.
At one time, Humpty was an egg, a unity, perhaps a god. But then, with a big bang, he shattered. That's what I remember about Humpty Dumpty. I like that story, actually, very much. But I wanted to go back to something you said about when you were talking about the organic quality of the fourth way. And at some point, Uspensky says that studying the teaching over time, he began to regard it as an organic entity, as an organic being. And I would say that most people who know me would describe me as a pretty rational and reasonable person, but I fully believe that, having studied the fourth way for 30 years, that's exactly my impression, that the more I interact, the more I try to apprehend this teaching, the more I try to apply it, the more I work with it, the more I understand it, the more it feels like something that exists, that informs me. And you know, I mean, when you were talking earlier about, I remember years and years ago, you were talking about the sun one day, and you said, yeah, the sun's not an intelligent being. All it does is, you know, keep planet Earth alive through the processes of photosynthesis and provision of light and heat, you know. And I mean, I was kind of locked
into
my...
Yeah, you'd ask, who's more intelligent?
Carl Sagan or the sun?
Yeah, I asked that, yeah, for 2 points. The chance to be on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, who's more intelligent, Carl Sagan or the sun,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I know that the capital of New York State is Albany, but the sun keeps everything alive through the process of photosynthesis. Who's smarter, me or the sun, you know? But I was sort of locked into my, well, the sun is a large galactic body that through the hydrogen, helium, burning, you know, I mean, the usual scientific perspective on things, which is right on one level, but it might not be the whole story, you know.
It's remarkable. Let's just take that example, and we're talking about the sun, and stay with the Gurdjieff teaching.
Oh, yeah.
It's very interesting. Nickel says in the Gurdjieff teaching, we are an experiment of the sun. An experiment in self-evolution, in a way. And that the level of the sun within us is the level of the spiritual body. And is actually, he relates it to the level of the sun within ourselves is related to the sun in the actual material sun in the solar system. The sun in the solar system, that is a level within ourselves. That's a level of consciousness. The consciousness of the sun, in a way, the yogis say we want to be sons of the sun. Or we are sons of the sun if we were awakened in what we are. That in a way we come from the sun, not material body, but the inner being, the inner consciousness. See, I actually argue, like, it's so interesting. Everybody knows about having a near-death experience, and you go down the tunnel, and it looks like the sun in the distance, and you go down this tunnel and you go into this spiritual world where there are spiritual beings, sometimes palaces and vistas, but it's like all in the spiritual world. Now, I spent time last year with Raymond Moody in Montreal at the conference, and Raymond Moody was very into the Greek philosophers, and I went up and I was able to sit with Raymond Moody in his hotel room, and we had a discussion, and I tried to engage in the Socratic dialogue with him. And I asked him, Dr. Moody, like, you know, people have this experience of going into this realm of light. And he said, yes. And I said, well, is that the sun? Can that be the sun? Actual, the sun, they go down the tunnel into a realm of light. Like, if you were to look around you in the world where such a realm might it be the sun? And he thought about it and pondered and said, yes. He saw no reason why not. And then I reminded him of Plato's myth, which is one of his favorites. where we see our shadow against the wall and the light is behind us. And in the myth, the person has to turn around and look into the light of true existence. But he can't acclimatize to it. It's so dazzling. He has to grow, look into it gradually to turn around to look into the light. And in this analogy, Plato's analogy of awakening from unconscious life, it ends with Plato saying, and finally will he see the sun in his own proper place. Isn't that neat, Jim?
That's
so Raymond Moody, we thought, oh, wow.
That's fantastic.
Like that was fascinating. I had this wonderful encounter with him last year in Montreal.
Maybe you should explain that Raymond Moody is the author of Life After Life, about the study of near-death experiences, who started out, incidentally, as being very skeptical about the validity of these and then began to study these experiences over and over again, just accumulated so many examples that he made a shift. He went from doubting that they existed to trying to understand them. I don't think I'm making that up, and I think that's a proper description of what he went through. Do you know that?
Yeah, well, there was another side. He had always had this attraction to Greek philosophy. I mean, in speaking with him, I said to him, you know, you must think you're reincarnated. I mean, to me, it's totally logical he was. You know, like, why are people attracted? Why is someone like Raymond Moody? What drew him to such a deep study of Greek philosophy?
Well,
and I would say he lived there and then there are deep roots to that through the life of the soul. I don't believe these things are just happenstance and circumstance. You know,
but when you say he's reincarnated, I mean, I would qualify that by saying, you know, I believe there are many instances suggestive of reincarnation, and Ian Stevenson, the psychiatrist, has studied this extensively. And I mean, just I've been reading recently about Tibetan Buddhism, and of course that's part of their culture, it's part of their belief system, and you know, they go and they look for the new Dalai Lama, and they present a child with objects that belong to the previous Dalai Lama, and if he identifies them, then he's the next Dalai Lama, and this happens over and over again. But when you say reincarnation, I guess my own feeling about it is that trying to understand this like possibility is that it could mean many different things. Like, it doesn't necessarily follow that someone is that soul reincarnated. You know, I mean, it could be that in this incarnation, someone is attuned to some ethereal, like Akashic record or some aspect of the past. So it's not necessarily.
Yes, I agree.
You know, I mean, maybe Raymond Moody's, you know, he's somehow, it's like, you know, it's like Mozart, you know, at 4 years old. How do you explain this? This kid, you know, 4-year-old kid can play music at this level and can compose music. Well, he's tuned into something on some level. I mean, I think that makes actually more sense than just saying, oh, he's a prodigy. I think he's tuned into something somehow. And I think other people show, you know, different, are adept at other faculties of, sometimes these involve, you know, connections with the past,
I see that as like the evolution and growth of the soul through different life experiences.
I
agree with what you're saying. Like, when I say, oh, you know, I believe Raymond Moody, I mean, I do believe he was reincarnated as dead. But I mean, the more general point, you're making the more general point. Maybe it's not what I'm saying, but maybe it's an affinity to soul studies and it was some elsewhere.
But maybe it is, too. You know, I'm just sort of tossing that out. It literally could be that, too, and it might be both, you know. I mean, or it might be either or, sort of. I'm not really sure. But
yes, it could. Yeah.
But that's a fascinating. That's interesting that you challenged him that way about the sun, you know. Could it be the sun? And that he actually thought about it and said, yeah, it could be the sun.
Yeah, it's so amazing because I've never read anyone in what I've read on near-death experiences who everyone says it's a realm like the sun. But no one ever thinks that, well, maybe it is the sun. Hello. Maybe no. What else? You know,
if it looks like the sun, if it's bright like the sun, if it's warm like the sun, maybe it's the sun.
Yeah, maybe it is the sun. Maybe, you know, I mean, and then that is so, we see how central sun worship has been, you know, to the yogis and rishis of India and Egyptian, all the cultures of the world. It's only modern mankind who's disenchanted the sun, that it's just a mass burning away unconsciously of matter and energy. There's no intelligence inherent to what the sun is and how it manifests.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that when I began to study consciousness through the fourth way and started looking at esoteric conceptualizations of consciousness, and then I sort of got interested in the history of science from the Enlightenment on, and what I realized through studying that is that essentially what happened is the evolution of the evolution of modern thought into this mechanistic worldview. Really, what happened was that you had a progressive withdrawal of all animism, all sacredness, all spiritual forces were gradually withdrawn from the universe and expunged from the universe. And really, the epitome of that is in behaviorism, where psychologists trying to be real scientists expunge the soul and spirit from human beings. So what you end up with is what Isaac Asimov describes, which is a human being as just, you know, a random happy agglomeration of molecules which will be alive for a while, and then they'll dissipate, and that'll be the end of the person. And really,
Francis Crick, the astonishing hypothesis was we're simply a pack of neurons.
Yeah, and I mean, really, when you look at the history of how this happened in science, nobody ever disproved any of these things. Nobody ever disproved animism. Nobody ever disproved the existence of spirit or the existence of the soul. These things were decisions undertaken in many cases for methodological reasons, and they were done by caveat and fiat, and they were done very arbitrarily. And really, you know, when science talks about how everything in science is submitted to disprovable hypotheses and repeated examinations, and you know that there's some sort of central governing body who makes sure that everything's on the up and up, that's just complete nonsense. Because really, things do happen within science according to certain protocols, but there's a whole underlying assumptive framework which is really based on a whole set of very arbitrary decisions about what the nature of the world and existence is. And I mean, they, as you say, for thousands of years throughout the world, all sorts of different cultures have worshipped the sun, and now we in modern times have realized that the sun's just a big gas bag and that, you know, that's it.
Yeah, and that's just simply burning
and
There's nothing more
to it. And you know, and that's considered to be a scientific and knowledge-able understanding of the sun.
Yeah.
Well,
and
you know,
it is a legitimate hypothesis.
It's a legitimate hypothesis,
but the problem is it's not considered a hypothesis. It's considered as proven and established.
Well, I don't even consider it in many respects. I mean, I think probably most people who study the sun, they've got the physics down. I'm sure that they're correct about it. I don't doubt for a minute the facts of science. I just doubt that this is a comprehensive explanation of what the sun is. You know, that as you keep saying, physicists have to come to the metaphysical and subtle realms. And in a way, I mean, they do, because really the material reductionist perspective that dominates modern science and modern physics really comes up against a bunch of dead ends, and you start to have to hypothesize all these different quasi subtle dimensions and realms to explain things, because really the material explanation is not a comprehensive explanation. It's very good for describing things at a certain level, but it can't go any further.
Yeah, and then what happens is science becomes riddled with enigmas.
And paradoxes, yeah.
I remember Uspensky saying, if we could collect together all the enigmas and unexplained facts within all the departments of science, it would wash away everything we thought we understood. And I think that's still today. Like, this whole modern misconception of consciousness produced by the brain, Okay, if you gather together all the enigmas, out-of-body experience, near-death experiences, possessions, ghosts, healing, all these enigmas, it just washes that assumptive framework away. I mean, it's a hypothesis. They don't brain scientists don't consider it a hypothesis. They think it's an established fact, and it's presented as fact when really it's speculation. You read this book by Blackmore, you realize all these biggest brains, they all have completely different ideas of what consciousness is. It's a plethora of all these different and contrasting viewpoints. None of them defines what consciousness is, and no one has any explanation for it. But it's everybody simply assumes it's produced by the mind in the brain, and that's it. They're all within that ballpark.
Yeah, and
no one imagines that consciousness might have to do with the sun. And that I wanted to come back to, that's the heart and the sun, and the light of consciousness kind of comes down throughout, within without, from the higher dimensional space of the heart, and it's related to the sun. Mystics relate the heart to the sun. They relate the mind in the head to the moon, because they say the jiva atma is in the spiritual divine spark within the heart is inherently self-illuminating like the sun. So it shares the same nature as what the sun is, but in the inner cosmos of a human being. And then the mind, it has no consciousness of its own. It's like the moon. You're conscious in the mind because you have the light of the sun within the heart. So it can illuminate the mind. So there's consciousness in the mind in the head. I'm not doubting that. But really that reflects the deeper origins of consciousness, which are related to the heart as the sun of a human being, as a cosmos.
Yeah, I wanted to say earlier that when you were talking about that book on Conversations on Consciousness, which brings together all these leading thinkers on consciousness and modern philosophy and science, what really strikes me is like what you were talking about the heart and your book Within Without the Heart Doctrine. You go through a variety, just an incredible assortment of different esoteric and ancient teachings, and over again, there's this description of the heart and being self-illuminating, and just what you were speaking of, and the mind reflecting, being akin to the moon. And I was really struck, I think, in considering your work, one of the reasons why I'm writing this book about your career, and one of the reasons why I'm writing it is that I would like to sort of present a condensed version of your ideas and your model. And if nothing else, I think what it shows is that really, if you look at what mystical and esoteric teachings put forward, these are profound ideas. And at the very least, if modern researchers in consciousness were to look at these ideas, it just throws such an incredible light on the assumptive framework that underlines all these ideas about consciousness. As you say, everybody's got these different explanations, everything. But, I mean, I firmly believe in the truth of these esoteric teachings. I do believe them. I've been studying them for 30 years. I've studied them within myself. I've studied them without myself. And I really believe that they make sense and that they provide a much more satisfying and comprehensive explanation of the nature of things. But I'll allow that they could be wrong. But at the very least, they're invaluable in terms of modern thought, in terms of exposing the assumptive framework that underlies everything, and really, when you look at it, it's not a very solid foundation for pursuing the study of consciousness. And in fact, I would argue that it's completely illusory. I think modern psychology and philosophy and science and their understanding of consciousness have completely missed the most essential aspects of the phenomena.
Yeah, and I think in our era, even it's so profoundly important we understand the esoteric teachings in all the world's religions, and in all true, I would say, esoteric teachings, I would say incorporate the heart doctrine in it. And I don't know of any major religious or metaphysical teaching that it does not. So, yeah, that's a common element then. So what we're saying is we can take this profound esoteric teaching in the world's religion and try to understand that as a scientific idea. It's not a, we're not interested in belief here. I'm not, personally.
Yeah,
I don't want to believe things. I want to experience and know things directly in my own inner being and self. And so we don't just want to believe it. We want to understand it and experience what it means.
Yeah, and the other side of all this, too, is that all these ideas, you know, there are many people who are out there who hopefully are listening today on BBS Radio, who may have some intellectual interest in these things, but really a lot of people, their interest in more is in knowing and understanding themselves and understanding the spiritual aspect of their own beings and trying to fulfill themselves as human beings. And I mean, that's what's so inspiring about these teachings too, is that, as I said, I was just reading over your book Microcosm, Macrocosm recently, and I can say that, you know, as much as I was looking at it intellectually and trying to help you to refine the writing and trying to see where you could explain things better and stuff, I was quite inspired by the feelings that arose in me as a result of just contemplating these ideas. And my God, you know, I mean, you realize that all these things that you think you know yourself, and I mean, even though I know I don't know myself, most of the time I walk around thinking I do know myself. You know, I know who I am, I'm pretty, you know, this and that. But then you realize, well, it's really all, as Plato says, you know, we're watching the shadows on the wall, but we're not really understanding. All of this is a projection of something more fundamental, that if we could turn around in ourselves and really see the light, which might be the sun, then we could really know the nature of reality of ourselves and of the world. And you know, all of these things happen in over a course of time. If you're really lucky, you might have an experience of enlightenment or cosmic consciousness. But I think in general, most people who do study these things happen over time, and little by little, you can come to this new appreciation and understanding of what you might be and what your possibilities in life might be. And it's incredibly inspiring, and it's incredibly interesting, but it's also incredibly inspiring and awe-inspiring in a sense too.
Yeah, it's totally. It's funny, I was thinking today before we began, I was thinking, boy, in a way, I remember that time when I came upon the Fourth Way teaching and read the Fourth Way by Uspensky. In a way, I count that, my life, it's like the life before that and then the life since that. It's like this point in my life that marks that milestone. Like, I'm now for something completely different than what I would say. And then that just grew and grew. And then, I mean, now I'm expounding like such an alternative conceptualization of reality. Really, I could never have imagined 30 years ago where that path, like, I had no idea where that would eventually lead. What was open to us as possibilities.
That's what I was going to ask you about an hour and a half ago, and I actually tried to start to say that, was that when you began studying these, studying the Fourth Way and encountering these ideas about the nature of consciousness, could you ever have imagined in any way that you would be talking about zero points and the material that you're, you know, that you're articulating now? And I mean, it's the Lao Tzu expression that the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. And I feel the same way. There is before the Fourth Way and before these studies, and there's everything after.
Cool. Yeah, it marks that point in life. Yeah, we can just begin to grasp the profound significance of such teachings of these, and in ourselves begin that, like, want to climb that ladder of realization and make efforts in our life. I love the phrase from Gurdjieff, to strive towards our own self-perfection in terms of being.
I have a question.
We want to awaken, we want to develop these higher faculties, attain these higher faculties of the mind and of the heart, of the higher centers. And for Gurdjieff, crystallize the higher being bodies for the life of the soul. All these ideas, which to other people now might seem so fanciful and unrealistic, now I realize there's a whole science to this. It's a perfectly coherent kind of model of a human being and creation physics and so on. It's amazing system of knowledge, and it just deepens and deepens through years and years of study.
I actually have an assignment for you guys.
Okay. Okay. Oh, so we have a call here. I think we might have a call. I don't know if we got a couple minutes left. Do we have a call here?
Yes, you do. Yes, I'm right here.
Yeah, we do have.
Now,
somebody.
I have a suggestion for you.
Yes.
If you want to study the levels of consciousness and get to the root of what consciousness is, you're going to have to do it very carefully, but use hypnosis and hypnotherapy and strip away the surface layers until you get to the very root. You're going to have to document it.
I'm having a hard time hearing you, sir. You're saying use hypnosis.
Use hypnosis and hypnotherapy to slowly and carefully strip away the layers of surface consciousness and the surface thoughts until you can get
to the very core. The way, it's funny in the way I see people as already hypnotized. It's like trying to become deconditioned. I mean, I can see the value of hypnosis, as you're saying, to explore these complexes which block that more primary experience of consciousness. I can see the value of those methods, but I don't think that's the most important route. In a way, I think we need to consciously make conscious efforts to attain consciousness.
The problem with that, through our own
self-study and through cultivating our awareness of being.
I've done that for years. The problem with it is that you're always going to get wound up and stuck with what your surface layers are thinking. You can never really get down to the deep root levels. You have to do that through some form of either self-hypnosis or something, because I've tried it and it doesn't work very well.
Well, I'm not sure because you tried it that means that it's
I'm not saying it's not going to work for you, I'm just saying
you're tending to suggest something more off the path generally in terms of hypnosis, which is kind of something partly maybe done to you from without. I mean, I think we both agree we need to strip away some of these veils but I think our approaches are very different. And
yes, but what you have to understand about hypnosis is all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. And you cannot do anything.
Well, I see us ourselves as already hypnotized, and we're trying to wake up out of this hypnosis. That's how I tend to see it more, but...
Yeah, I understand. Well, I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
But through hypnosis,
I've been through different past life regressions, and that was hypnotic procedure done by Ian Curry, and it was profound experiences I had through the process you described. So I can certainly see the value in what you're saying as a route of exploring the deep roots of your own consciousness. I mean, I've worked with a client who I took back through 8 to 10 lives, seemingly,
mm-hmm.
you know, exploring those deep roots of consciousness. But even in terms of understanding the physics of being,
You're not going to find it in
that's,
you're not going to find
I'm,
it in
I'm
physics.
Losing you a bit.
Well,
thank
I'll
you,
let
sir.
You guys go.
I didn't catch you clearly. Is the gentleman still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Well, if you want to make a further comment, sir, otherwise we just have a few minutes. And thanks for calling in. You're the first caller.
Sure. Goodbye.
Do you do any past life work with hypnosis?
I wish I could. I'm one of those unfortunate few that goes from a very light state to a very deep Elsdale state spontaneously.
Yeah. I think hypnosis as a method can be very useful to us exploring the deep roots of consciousness, as you say. I'm not meaning to deny that or argue that, but there are other aspects and practices and such which are really important, too.
Yeah, I agree. It's just... That's the one that's been frustrating me for, 30 years, because I can't experience any of the intermediate levels of hypnosis.
I'm not hearing you well, sir, but I wonder about what do you make of what I'm saying about the awakening of the human heart? Like, have you experienced an awakening of your heart through the process of hypnosis and kind of deep work like that?
I won't say it's an awakening of the heart. It is, however, I do, however, seem to have a knack for coming to understanding, to an understanding of the spiritual regularities of life. I see things slightly differently. I see them from a spiritual perspective. It's not something I studied to do, but it's just something I do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess you could say I have an awakening. It's just, it's subtle.
It's such an amazing process, because I think there's so many kind of levels of realization and awakening, and it's really such a process, and it's a wonderful life adventure. And I'm going to have to cut you off because we do only have a few minutes. Thank you very much for calling in and sharing your comments, sir.
Sure. Bye.
Goodbye. Okay, I guess we're winding down here. I think we just got a few more minutes. Okay, different. I got different watches here, different times. This watch, I got 6 minutes. I'm not sure if we end exactly on the hour. Jim, did you have any kind of... I felt it was a wonderful discussion today. It thrills me. It brings it all back. It kind of brings... You remember it all. It's like... I remember one person saying, if we could remember everything we know at once, we could be so illumined, kind of, you know, but it's like we forget everything. So it's like remembering and forgetting. And
yeah, well,
it's like we go back over this material. It reminds, every time I hear it, it's like you hear it fresh in a new way and understand it more deeply somehow.
Well, consciousness means to know together, and that's in a sense what it is. It's an attempt to bring everything together. And the same thing, I mean, for me, is that each time we discuss this, it becomes... You know, as you see it from with fresh eyes and fresh senses and with more history, which makes it new and even more meaningful. But you know, the only problem is that I hope that we for some of our listeners that we don't jump around too much. But there's so many associations that each comment seems to trigger that it's hard sometimes to, you know, try to reel yourself in and try to stay focused and continue the thread. You know, and
it's ironic that ashtray story.
Oh yeah. Well,
if you knew everything there was to know about an ashtray, that ends up implicating the universe.
Kind of. I think actually, Uspensky said a man could go mad from just one ashtray or something.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
Yeah, but Gurdjieff said if somebody really knew how to make a good cup of coffee, they'd really know and understand something. You know, and of course he was just referring to the whole idea, like, well, if you knew how to grow coffee beans, you know, and get them to market, and then, you know, the whole process that's involved, you know, you'd know so much. But it's interesting that gentleman who phoned in, we had a caller, that's great, that gentleman who phoned in talked about hypnosis, because you and I had a real interest in hypnosis before we came to the fourth way and had experimented quite a bit. And for me, I understand on a certain level what he's saying about stripping away the level of what he's describing, and I guess for different people, different things work. But as you say, I sort of take the opposite tack. I see it more like we're hypnotized already, and the idea is to wake up. Although we it may be semantical in that sense, but I mean, for me, I've done past life regressions, and I got nothing out of it. I just, you know, to me, it was just imagination. It's like David Letterman says, you know, like top 10 things Shirley MacLaine was in a previous life, you know, big dumb fish. Maybe I was a big dumb fish. You know, like, I don't know. But I certainly wasn't in the court of Nefertiti or anything, you know. I wasn't the queen of England. So I don't know. I guess, but, you know.
Another thing, I jump in here before leaving this idea. It reminds me also of Uspensky quoting Gurdjieff, and Gurdjieff saying, you can use hypnosis to separate a man's personality from their essence. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And that's in a way, to strip away the false personality and the conditioning to get a person back into their essence. And he said he had very complicated people, very intellectual and cultured, and he, under hypnosis, where you strip away the false personality, it's like in their essence, just as a child, that they haven't grown in their essence. But you could use hypnosis to separate those two. But in a way, the personality and false personality is a hypnosis. It's like we've been conditioned and we want to awaken from this.
Well, let's come back to that the next time, because I remember he hypnotized this very intellectual man, and he said, I'd like some strawberry jam. And when he was hypnotized, you know, and that's what he was interested in, was strawberry jam. But that's a very interesting point. We should talk about that. And, of course, Gurdjieff was a professional hypnotist at one point in his life. So
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he had very interesting views on hypnosis. He said inducing the hypnotic state involved altering the blood flow in the body.
And also the relation of the systolic to the diastolic pressure, too.
Yeah. So it all, again, relates consciousness and state or
to blood flow.
State of consciousness to blood. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we need to finish up and thank the listeners and visit website zeropoint.ca. I have some fascinating books here. If anyone would like to buy a book from me, support Zero Point Institute or Zero Point Work. I appreciate that. And again, I'd like to thank James Moffitt for being with me through the day today. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'd like to thank Don and Doug at BBS Radio. Thank you very much, and until next time, remember yourself.